content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We are reading this week from the February 28th, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows the Lady of Justice statue. She is actually in a chair. She's been tied up. She's blinded, and she's also gagged. And in the background is a guilty-looking Bill Barr. He's holding her scales. They're all bent up, and he's walking away. The headline is Kidnapping Justice. Are Barr and Trump using the law for partisan ends? And that is our first main story. Barr's plea to Trump to stop tweeting. What happened? Attorney General William Barr was under fire from all directions this week as more than 2,000 former Department of Justice officials from both parties called on him to resign and accused him of repeatedly flouting the department's sacred obligation to administer equal justice under the law. The extraordinary open letter came after the nation's top lawmen watered down the department's sentencing recommendation of 7 to 9 years in prison for President Trump's longtime friend and political fixer, Roger Stone, 67. Barr's intervention led four federal prosecutors to resign from the case, with one quitting the DOJ entirely. In their letter, the ex-U.S. attorneys, trial lawyers, and other DOJ officials accused Barr of blatantly politicizing the department. Governments that use the enormous power of law enforcement to punish their enemies and reward their allies are not constitutional republics. They are autocracies, they wrote. Meanwhile, the Federal Judges Association, a collection of 1,100 jurists devoted to an independent judiciary, called an emergency meeting to discuss what it called a deepening crisis caused by Barr and Trump's intervention in politically sensitive cases. Trump had congratulated Barr for changing the sentencing recommendations on Stone, saying they were a disgrace and a miscarriage of justice. The next day, Barr said in a televised interview that Trump should stop the tweeting about DOJ cases because his comments make it impossible for me to do my job. But Trump continued tweeting over ensuing days, and Barr reportedly told sources close to the president that if he didn't stop, he'd resign. Democrats said Barr's involvement in the Stone sentencing was only the latest example of the attorney general taking charge of cases important to Trump. On Barr's orders, the department is pursuing investigations of former FBI and CIA officials involved in the Russia investigation. Barr has also set up a process to receive and vet information about Democrat Joe Biden that Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, is digging up from dodgy pro-Russia sources in Ukraine. 2 weeks ago, federal prosecutors changed the recommendation of 6 months in prison for former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn to probation. Last week, Barr tapped outside prosecutors to review not only Flynn's case, but also a number of others described as politically sensitive. What the editorial said. Barr must go, said the Boston Globe. In the year since his appointment, he's made a mockery of the DOJ's long-standing independence from the White House. He whitewashed Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report, attacked the DOJ's Inspector General for finding no political bias in the original FBI investigation of Trump's campaign, and is now working fist in glove with Giuliani as he hunts for political dirt in Ukraine. Barr is upset by Trump's tweets because they expose him as not an independent defender of the laws, but as the servant of one man, Trump. Trump is his own worst enemy, said the Wall Street Journal. He should be celebrating his Senate acquittal, campaigning for re-election, and enjoying the disarray of his opponents. Instead, his relentless popping off has handed Democrats another scandal to flog and undermined his attorney general, whom he can ill afford to lose. With his reckless need to settle scores, Trump is making millions of voters ask if they really want to take a risk on giving him so much power for another 4 years. What the columnist said, "Don't mistake Barr's rebuke of Trump for a principled stand," said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. "Since becoming Attorney General, Barr has transformed the Justice Department into Trump's own private detective agency. But Barr understands that using the law to punish political adversaries and reward allies requires a sheen of public legitimacy. That's why he took issue with Trump's tweets. The president keeps exposing the fact that he's turned the legal system into a personal weapon." The ongoing Democratic hysteria over Barr is a cliche of the Trump era, said Eddie Scari in WashingtonExaminer.com. "Someone should tell the resistance that above the law is a banal phrase that actually means, I don't like that." Critics should also consider the possibility that Barr may have done the right thing for the right reason, said Jonathan Turley in TheHill.com. Before Trump started tweeting, many legal experts had conceded that 7 to 9 years for Stone was excessive. "Not since Watergate have I seen such un-American assault on the core principles that have guided our justice system," said former Republican Deputy Attorney General Donald Ayer in TheAtlantic.com. In chilling terms, Barr has repeatedly stated that the Constitution endows the president with nearly autocratic powers, with total authority over the Justice Department and the right to order and end investigations. He insists that Congress and the courts have encroached on the president's autonomy and that their oversight is mere harassment. Barr's America would be a banana republic, and it is not a place that anyone, including Trump voters, should want to go. We'll read the second main story. Fear and uncertainty as coronavirus outbreak spreads. What happened? Public health officials in China and the West scrambled to slow the spread of the new coronavirus this week amid growing fears that a global pandemic may be impossible to stop. The respiratory illness has so far infected more than 75,200 people and killed at least 2,006. More than 98% of all cases have occurred in China. Authorities said the spread of the epidemic appeared to be slowing, but with the number of cases outside China surging, health experts warned against optimism that the disease might be peaking. At least 47 infections have been reported in Europe and more than 70 in Japan. Pandemic fears jumped after the Westerdam, a cruise ship that was repeatedly turned away from Asian ports over coronavirus fears, disembarked more than 1,000 passengers in Cambodia. Those passengers then headed to airports. One, an American, tested positive upon reaching Malaysia. "This could be a turning point," said William Schaffner, an infectious disease specialist at Vanderbilt University. A second cruise ship docked in Japan, the Diamond Princess, reported more than 600 cases. Some 300 Americans on board, including 14 who'd tested positives, were airlifted to U.S. military bases, where they will be quarantined for 2 weeks. That brought the number of confirmed cases in the U.S. to 29, but experts say the total number is likely far higher. Scott Gottlieb, former commissioner of the FDA, told Congress that the U.S. is detecting 25% of cases at best. Asha George, head of the Bipartisan Commission on Biodefense, said the country may ultimately see hundreds of thousands of cases. What the editorial said: "The virus has unleashed a political maelstrom that threatens Chinese President Xi Jinping," said the Financial Times. "In an unprecedented display of defiance, ordinary Chinese have vented their anger online over the government's mismanagement of the crisis, silencing of whistleblowers, and willingness to lie to its citizens to save face. Beijing's authoritarian might and ability to marshal resources on a vast scale have lifted millions of its citizens out of poverty. But as wealth grows, people thirst not only for material well-being, but also for dignity. We face many huge unknowns about the virus, said the Guardian. We don't know how long it lingers on a contaminated surface, for example, or how infectious people are before showing symptoms of the disease. But uncertainty is no excuse for inaction. Now is the time to take measures to head off pandemics that could catch us off guard in the future. We could start by improving health services in poor areas of Asia and Africa. Outbreaks of deadly new diseases, wherever they emerge, are not someone else's problem. What the columnist said, if a coronavirus epidemic hits the U.S., it could bring out the worst in President Trump, said Peter Nicholas in TheAtlantic.com. Having already stoked fears about disease-bearing foreigners, he would likely double down on xenophobic suspicions during an outbreak. He'll need a sturdy bureaucracy to stop the virus spread, but over the past 3 years, he's hollowed out federal agencies and belittled expertise. Should a pandemic land on our shores, we'll learn the hard way that tweets don't beget vaccines. To know if we are facing a pandemic, we need answers to two basic questions, said Julia Belutz in Vox.com. How deadly is the virus, and how easily does it spread? Studies suggest a reproduction number, how many people a sick person is likely to infect, between 2 and 3.11. That's higher than the flu or SARS. But figures from China indicate the virus mortality rate is about 2.3%. That's far below SARS' 10% mortality rate. Still, at this early stage, these numbers are just informed guesses. However much we'd like to know everything right now, we just don't, said John Allen Paulos in the New York Times. Accurate infection counts are notoriously tricky. People who experience the virus as a mild cold, for example, won't go to the doctor. Fatality rates can also be hard to determine. The virus might be blamed for the deaths of vulnerable people suffering from serious conditions such as diabetes. We have to accept the discomfort of our uncertainty, which is all the more reason to abide by one of the things we do know at this point. You should wash your hands regularly. Our controversy of the week is titled, Sanders, Can He Win Broad Support? Bernie Sanders may now be the front runner for the Democratic presidential nomination, said Dylan Scott in Vox.com. But anxious moderates are deeply worried that his signature policy, Medicare for All, is a political albatross. Last week, the powerful Culinary Workers Union of Nevada distributed flyers urging its 60,000 members to oppose Medicare for All when participating in the February 22nd caucus, because it would terminate the generous employer-provided health care plan they'd won through labor negotiations. The Culinary Workers' opposition hints at a bigger problem for Sanders' campaign. While Medicare for All polls well, 56% in the abstract, support plummets to 37% when voters are told it means the end of private insurance, on which 180 million Americans currently depend. Some of Sanders' supporters seem to recognize this danger, said Joseph Zabalos Ruig in BusinessInsider.com. His key surrogate, New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, said that people shouldn't let Medicare for All keep them from supporting Sanders, because Congress won't pass such a sweeping reform anyway. By putting single payer on the table, she said, Sanders can get a public option, that is, Medicare for those who want it, as a compromise. But are Sanders supporters willing to settle for a compromise? Asked Jennifer Medina and Jonathan Martin in the New York Times. After Culinary Workers distributed its flyers, Culinary Secretary Treasurer says she was inundated with hundreds of abusive texts and phone calls, with Sanders supporters calling union leaders bitches and evil entitled blankos. Sanders has made rhetorical overtures towards civility, said Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. But he has surrounded himself with people who viciously attack anyone who opposes him. They are scaring away those voters less interested in revolution than in finding someone, anyone, who can beat Donald Trump. Sanders could certainly use some messaging adjustments, said Eric Levitz in NYMag.com. Though he won New Hampshire, his margins of victory in the popular vote were meager. The Vermont senator's professed game plan to turn out droves of young and disaffected first-time voters hasn't panned out. Turnout among under 30 voters in both Iowa and New Hampshire was unremarkable. Sanders needs to broaden his appeal to his fellow seniors, who fear that Medicare expansion will dilute their own benefits. He needs to remind them that he alone has a plan for universal long-term care and increasing Social Security benefits. To broaden his appeal to other Democrats, Sanders should more frequently engage in personal narrative about how he was shaped by growing up in a lower-middle-class Jewish family deeply impacted by the Holocaust. Sanders is the best when he makes sincere Obama-esque appeals to Americans' common humanity. More of that, please. Sanders may not admit it, said Paul Waldman in the Washington Post, but he's more of a pragmatist than either his critics or superfans realize. As AOC pointed out, Sanders' extreme policies can serve as negotiating positions from which he can compromise to achieve less radical but still valuable reforms. Giving all Americans the option to enroll in Medicare, for example, could be a much more dramatic reform than the Affordable Care Act and serve as a way station on the road to single payer. So why doesn't Sanders just admit that? Unlike some of his more, quote, electable rivals, Sanders knows you don't compromise with yourself before negotiations begin. Good week, bad week. It was a good week for Earthlings. After an asteroid larger than the tallest building on Earth whizzed by the planet at a distance of 3.6 million miles, a direct hit would have killed millions immediately, said NASA, and triggered a years-long nuclear winter and mass extinctions. It was a good week for putrefaction after Burger King launched a new ad showing a Whopper rotting and growing mold over 34 days to show the beauty of no artificial preservatives. Adweek's David Greiner called it one of the boldest, most bizarre ad campaigns I've ever seen. And it was a good week for Florida's lobster lovers, for whom the price of local spiny lobster has plunged because coronavirus-related travel restrictions have cut off air shipments to the lucrative Chinese market. For the next month or so, said restaurateur Steve Guyland of North Palm Beach, we can enjoy lobster for a reasonable price. But it was a bad week for COVID Inc., an Arizona-based manufacturer of audiovisual cables, after the World Health Organization named the coronavirus COVID-19. COVID CEO Norm Carson called the coincidence surreal and unfortunate. It was a bad week for romance, with the announcement by Jeff Gebhardt, 47, of Kansas City, that he'll pay $25,000 to anyone who can find him a girlfriend who'll date him exclusively for a year. Women who are recommended must take a survey based on science, Gebhardt said. Finally, it was a bad week for winter, with the opening in Norway of Snow, S-N-O, an indoor skiing center featuring artificial snow and painted backdrops of Scandinavian forests. The winters are varying a bit more than one would wish, explained director Morten Dybdahl. A short news piece before we go. Federal laws waived for border wall. The Trump administration said this week that it will waive federal contracting laws to fast-track construction of 177 miles of border fencing in California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. The government has already used waivers to sidestep environmental impact reviews for fence construction. But in a first, the Department of Homeland Security will now waive 10 procurement laws, including a requirement to hold open competition for contracts and giving losing bidders the chance to appeal. It's equivalent to buying a car without seeing the sticker price, said Scott Amey, general counsel of the Project on Government Oversight. The White House expects 94 miles of barriers to be built this year, bringing Trump closer to his goal of erecting 450 miles of wall on the Mexican border. We're on the briefing page. The title is Scam PACs, P-A-C-S. Con men are using political action committees to bilk donors of tens of millions of dollars. What are scam PACs? They are political action committees that claim to raise money for a candidate or a good cause, but spend little or none of the donated funds for those purposes. People running scam PACs either pocket the money outright in the form of salaries and perks or, more subtly, funnel the donations to a network of companies, consultants, marketers, fundraisers, in which the PAC's managers have a stake. These phony PACs have noble-sounding names like Coalition for American Veterans or For a Better America and pretend to support good causes like firefighters, veterans, and disease victims. Some claim to support political candidates such as President Trump or Senator Bernie Sanders. Typically, however, 80 to 90% of the money raised is spent on overhead, and in egregious cases, as much as 99%. The money primarily goes to the people who are running the PAC, said Brett Kappel, campaign finance specialist at Ackerman LLP. Why do they get away with it? Charities are policed by state authorities, but scam PACs are not covered by these laws and regulations. They register as political organizations and thus enjoy considerable legal protection for their activities. In fact, said Adav Noti, a former Federal Election Commission lawyer, federal and state authorities have largely said they can't prosecute scam PACs that don't conceal where the money went or engage in other outright lies. PAC operators can always claim it costs money to raise money, Noti said. It's hard to bring cases unless you have evidence disproving that. That gives scam PACs a relatively free hand. I had breast cancer, so they knew how to get me, said Joanne Coleman, 63, a donor to a PAC called Americans for the Cure of Breast Cancer, which took in $1.6 million in donations over 2.5 years and made exactly one $10,000 contribution for research over that period. What a racket, said Coleman. How do they operate? Most scam PACs hire telemarketing firms to contact would-be donors. These telemarketers often target retirees for the scripted calls. A recent Reuters investigation found that the fundraisers often operate out of nondescript strip mall offices in states like New Jersey, Alabama, Florida, and Nevada. These telemarketing firms often operate under multiple names, shut down, and then reemerge under new names. Alexander Leffler, who worked for one such firm called TPFE, Inc. in Alabama, said he'd been instructed to pitch whatever cause he was hawking like it was a charity, but as quickly and quietly as you can, slip in that it was a PAC. Jason Jones, who made calls for a firm called Politicause, said, "You are not lying, but you are being extremely misleading." In one instance, Jones told Reuters, a person he called asked how much of the money would actually go to the charity. We are proud to say it's a 90-10 split, Jones remembered reading from a script. He neglected to explain that it was his company that would be keeping the 90%. We wish it was 100, he told the potential donor, but we have to keep the lights on. How many are there? There are dozens of scam packs popping in and out of existence, and they raise a lot of money. Kyle Prawl of Austin was recently sentenced to 3 years in prison for raising $548,428 for several PACs, including Feel Burn and Trump Victory, while donating a total of less than $5,100 to the candidates. He made the mistake of making explicit claims to donors about how the money would be used, while spending it instead on exotic vacations, lap dances, deep tissue massage, and even a pet cleaning fee. In December, Politico.com reported that almost 20 unofficial pro-Trump PACs had legally siphoned off $46.7 million in donations during the 2.5 years from his inauguration to mid-2019. One Great America PAC paid almost $1 million to a public affairs firm registered to the PAC's co-chairman. There's nothing we can do to stop them, said Kelly Sadler, a spokeswoman for America First, the one super PAC sanctioned by Trump. This is a problem for the campaign, as well as us, as well as for the RNC. Who else has been targeted? One California con man focused exclusively on Democrats and progressive causes, leveraging a network of PACs to purportedly raise more than $250,000 for Bernie Sanders, Beto O'Rourke, and immigrant children. One now convicted swindler, Carrie Lee Peterson of Phoenix, raised $90,000 for his pro-Sanders PAC, Americans Socially United, including a $47,300 donation from James Bond actor Daniel Craig, but spent virtually nothing to help Sanders. Still, successful prosecutions remain rare. Last year, a U.S. district judge struck down the FEC rules barring unauthorized PACs from using a candidate's name. FEC Chair Ellen Weintraub said the ruling would lead to confusion in the political marketplace and a wide opening for scam PACs to exploit. It's time to read a few of the columns, but on the page that the columns start, this picture caught my eye, and so I just have to read you one of the items from It Must Be True. I read it in the tabloids. A water skiing squirrel has become the focus of a legal battle in Vancouver, British Columbia. Twiggy is delighting fans by performing at the Vancouver International Boat Show on tiny water skis, wearing a hand-sewn life preserver. But city officials have told the show it is violating an obscure law that prohibits the use of rodents in competitions, exhibitions, performances, or events. Twiggy, however, continues to perform in violation of the city order. In defending his use, a spokeswoman for the boat show said that Twiggy's act is educational, and it helps kids learn about life jacket safety. And so on to the columns. We'll start with the likability trap for women. After Senator Amy Klobuchar's strong third-place finish in Iowa, said Monica Hess, many Democrats wondered if maybe a woman did have a shot at winning the election after all. Klobuchar is a savvy Midwestern moderate who has the right mix of tough and empathetic. But Democrats should remember this feeling of liking her because something funny happens when women become serious candidates for the presidency. In 2016, Hillary Clinton entered the presidential race with a 65% approval rating. But then people began saying she was too shrill, too conniving, and her voice. A similar phenomenon occurred to highly popular Democrats Senator Kamala Harris and Senator Elizabeth Warren in the 2020 race. Both suddenly were deemed shrill, inauthentic, and deeply flawed. Multiple studies have shown that likability is optional for male candidates, but is a requirement for female candidates, especially for those who run for president. Voters often decide that forceful, ambitious women are lecturing them and remind them of their mother-in-law or ex-wife. If Klobuchar's rise leads to her being called unlikable and unpresidential, it will have everything to do with her being a woman. This is from France. Puritanical moralizing is un-French. American-style Puritanism has infected French politics, said Camille Sarrazin. Benjamin Griveaux, the former spokesman for President Emmanuel Macron's centrist government, was forced to withdraw his candidacy for mayor of Paris last week after explicit videos and sexts that he allegedly sent to his mistress were leaked online. Griveaux, who has made much of his conservative values as a married father of three, didn't confirm whether he was the individual in the images, but said he was quitting the race to protect his family. The leak, orchestrated by self-promoting Russian performance artist Pyotr Pavlensky, is an outrageous breach of France's political norms, which have always held that private and public life are separated by an impermeable wall. Other politicians from across the political spectrum voiced support for that separation and for Griveaux, 42. His main rival in the race for Paris mayor, socialist incumbent Anne Hidalgo, said private affairs were not worthy of democratic debate, while Sébastien Chenu of the far-right National Rally said that France should not look to elect saints, but people who have ideas and skills. Still, pundits worry that despite universal condemnation, the door has been open to personal attacks. Commentator Alain Duhamel said France has now imported the worst of American political life. Welcome to the United States. This is from Mexico. Slaughter of women goes ignored. Mexican women are furious at their government's anemic response to an epidemic of gender violence, said Carmen Moran Breña. An average of 10 women a day are killed in Mexico, mostly by current or former partners, a chilling toll that has sparked months of protest by women's groups. Their anger reached boiling point last week when Ingrid Escamilla, a 25-year-old Mexico City resident, was murdered and skinned by her partner. Yet President Andrés Manuel López Obrador merely reacted with exasperation when asked about the femicide crisis, saying the issue was being manipulated by his opponents. Worse, his attorney general, Alejandro Gertz Manero, has proposed eliminating the charge of femicide, saying it is too difficult to determine whether any given female homicide victim was murdered because of her gender. Maria Candelaria Ochoa Avalos, a lawmaker with López Obrador's party who heads his Commission on Violence, argues that misogyny is entrenched in society and so must be fought in the family, in the school, in the unions, in the institutions, in the churches. That's a cop-out. The president has almost total power in our political system. López Obrador has simply chosen not to use it to halt the mounting casualties in this war against women. Our in-depth article this week, The Last Word, also involves Mexico. The title is Exile in Tijuana. Migrants from far beyond the Americas, the extracontinentales, have converged on the border city hoping to be let into the U.S., said journalist Jack Herrera in Politico.com. Now they may have no way to leave. Tijuana, Mexico. If you go early in the morning to the plaza in front of El Chaparral, the border crossings where a person can walk from Mexico into the state of California, you'll hear shouts like 2,578 El Salvador and 2,579 Guatemala, a number followed by a place of origin. Every day, groups of families gather around, waiting anxiously underneath the trees at the back of the square. The numbers come from La Lista, the list. When a person's number is called, it's their turn to ask for asylum in the United States. These days, the most common place names shouted are Michoacan or Guerrero, Mexican states where intense cartel violence has sent thousands fleeing northward. Occasionally, the list keepers will call Guatemala, El Salvador, or Honduras. Countries where pervasive poverty, gangs, drugs, and femicide have done the same. But every so often, the name of a more far-off country is called. In the span of 2 weeks late last year, list keepers called out numbers for people from Russia, Armenia, Ghana, and Cameroon. Asylum seekers from Congo crossed, as well as Eritreans. One day, the list keeper called out Turkey, and a Turkish family rushed forward to claim their spot. The family was escorted by Mexican immigration officials over the walkway into the United States, where they told Customs and Border Protection agents that they had, like everyone else, left their home country fleeing for their lives. These people were the lucky ones. They had managed to persist in Tijuana, waiting until the day they finally heard their numbers called. Others haven't been so fortunate. With the list queue regularly stretching longer than 6 months, many migrants fall victim to predatory robbery, kidnapping, or murder before they can find refuge. For others, they wait in one of the most dangerous cities in the world is simply unendurable. When Americans think of the people crossing at the southern border, they might imagine Mexicans or Central Americans, or even more generally, Latin Americans. But migration, both legal and illegal, from Mexico into the United States is incredibly international. In the course of 2018, Border Patrol agents apprehended nearly 9,000 Indians, 1,000 Chinese nationals, 250 Romanians, 150 Pakistanis, 159 Vietnamese, and dozens of citizens of more than 100 other countries. 15 Albanians and 7 Italians were stopped trying to cross the southern border, as were 4 people from Ireland, a single person from Japan, and 3 people each from Syria and Taiwan. Border Patrol even apprehended 2 North Koreans on the border in 2018 who were separately attempting to cross in various parts of Texas. Mexicans call these asylum seekers extracontinentales, a word for immigrants who come from outside of the Americas. Now, one of the most direct effects of President Trump's border policy is that thousands of extracontinentales have found themselves unexpectedly stuck on the southern border, waiting for their number to be called from the list. When I met asylum seekers in El Chaparral and around Tijuana, most of them told me they'd been waiting in the city for months. Even though U.S. laws say that anyone who claims to be fleeing for their life should be immediately admitted to a port of entry for vetting, under the Trump administration, Border Patrol has started a controversial policy of metering. Now agents accept only a set number of asylum seekers each day and send the rest back. In Tijuana, they accept around 20 to 60 people per day, while thousands are left waiting and more are constantly arriving. That's how the list was born. Migrants themselves began keeping a ledger as an attempt to create a fair waiting system, a virtual line to get past the manufactured bottleneck. Many potentially legitimate asylum seekers who once might have found at least temporary refuge in the United States while their applications were being reviewed are now made to undertake a harrowing and dangerous journey across the world, only to be forced to wait in Mexico's borderlands, and are less likely than ever to be allowed in later. Across the border, Mexican cities like Tijuana are struggling to deal with a shifting crisis of their own, with thousands of desperate people stuck in a foreign country they never intended to stay in, struggling to survive in a region afflicted by its own intense violence and poverty. Though the experience of being a foreigner in northern Mexico can be isolating, Tijuana is decidedly an international city. Long a transit point, it's become a cosmopolitan center. Russians, for instance, have been arriving in the city since the late 1940s. Many fled the former USSR, and there's even a popular taco stand called Tacos El Ruso, with a cartoon on the wall that proclaims, "Que rico tacosquis." This multinational character is particularly vivid in a city's only mosque, a small plain building in the city's west, not far from the Pacific Ocean. During Friday prayers in October, I watched as the imam began his sermon in Spanish before transitioning to English, though many of the men gathered didn't speak either language. We've got people from Egypt, Turkey, Russia, Tajikistan, Pakistan, Afghanistan, I mean, everywhere. You name it, we've got it, Imam Omar Islam, a Mexican board convert, told me. He says many of the people he meets in the mosque have come fleeing conflict in their home countries, trying to make it to the U.S. The men mostly arrive in groups with their compatriots, Egyptians with Egyptians, Indians with Indians, but during prayer, the group comes together as one, and at the end of the imam's sermon, they rise to greet one another. There was a young man who escaped civil war in Yemen who shook hands with a group of West Africans, including Emmanuel, a pseudonym I'm using to protect his identity, who fled multiple homophobic attacks in Ghana. Today, as the Trump administration cracks down on the asylum process, many migrants who first intended to go to the U.S. have decided to stay in Mexico. Some seek humanitarian visas, while others try their luck as undocumented immigrants. Emmanuel, however, told me he has no desire to stay in Tijuana. With clear West African features, he stands out, and he says he's been beaten and robbed multiple times by thieves who target the vulnerable migrant population. "I can't stay here. It's too dangerous," he said. In 2018, Tijuana was, by some measures, the murder capital of the world. And according to reports by the U.S.-based advocacy organization Human Rights First, refugees and migrants face acute risk of kidnapping, disappearance, sexual assault, trafficking, and other grave harms in Mexico. Emmanuel plans on crossing the border and asking for asylum in the United States, but his number on the list is weeks, if not months, away. After his last robbery, he says he can't afford rent. He's desperate and unsure what to do. For many of these extracontinentales, stalled in the north of Mexico, the U.S. border is simply the final obstacle at the end of an immense odyssey. There's a fairly straightforward reason why so many people from around the world end up in northern Mexico, even though their ultimate destination is the United States. Visa restrictions. For many people, it's impossible to fly straight into the U.S. without a visa. So many asylum seekers fly into Latin American countries with the plan to travel northward. For people with stronger passports, like Russian, Indian, and Chinese nationals, it's possible to fly directly into Mexico. Many of the extracontinentales land first in Mexico City or Cancun, where they masquerade as tourists before making their way to the border. The rate of arrival is higher than you might think. On a single Monday when I was in Tijuana, six Russians and two Chinese nationals were detained at the airport on charges of traveling with forged or improper documents. They were promptly returned. But many people from Africa and Middle Eastern countries have trouble securing travel even to Mexico. So forced migrants like Emmanuel, the journey through the Americas begins much further south, in Ecuador, one of the few countries on the planet where, until recently, Ghanaians could travel without a visa. From Ecuador, the path to the U.S. demands a trek into Colombia and then to the border with Panama. At this point, the journey becomes incredibly perilous. Many do not survive. There is no road between the jungles of northern Colombia through the swamps into central Panama. Traveling on foot, northbound migrants must walk first over cloud forest and then across 50 miles of marshland through a stretch of sparsely populated wilderness called the Darien Gap. The trip is, by all accounts, brutal. Reporting from northern Mexico in the past year, I've spoken with asylum seekers from Ghana, Cameroon, Venezuela, and Congo, who all said they had made this trek. The stories they tell are harrowing. People die from snake bite or from drowning. Many eat nothing but uncooked rice for the week it takes to transit the gap. Along the migration routes, human traffickers, kidnappers, and robbers prey on travelers. People get robbed in every country, but every person I spoke with, without exception, said they were robbed at gunpoint by bandits in the jungle in Panama. Emmanuel made the journey northward from Ecuador not just once, but twice. After he first fled homophobic violence in Ghana in 2016, Emmanuel made it to the U.S. border and crossed at the official port of entry. As he argued his asylum case in court, he remained in Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention. He says he learned English while there. After almost 2 years, Emmanuel was hopeless and depressed. He decided he couldn't stay locked up anymore and chose to give up on his asylum case. ICE deported him back to Accra. Once returned to Accra, Emmanuel was attacked again by the men who originally persecuted him. Emmanuel said he's not gay, but he welcomed LGBTQ patrons into the mechanic shop he ran. Nevertheless, people in his community accused him of being gay and tried to kill him, he says. He showed me huge scars on his belly from stab wounds and a video someone filmed soon after he was returned to Ghana, showing him bloody and unconscious in a crowded hospital. Fearing death, Emmanuel escaped again and flew back to Ecuador this past spring. He says the journey is the hardest thing he's ever done. But still, he chose to make the trek a second time. He says he had no choice. He is certain he'll be killed if he ever returns. In July, the Trump administration announced it would no longer accept asylum applications from people who transited through a third country on their way to the U.S. Anyone who traveled through Mexico without first applying for asylum there could be returned automatically. The asylum restriction, immediately challenged in court, has been temporarily upheld by the Supreme Court pending a final decision. If the new restrictions stand, the wait for extracontinentales could turn out to be permanent. The new rules also mean that asking for asylum in the U.S. now comes with a dramatically increased risk of deportation back to one's home country. But people trying to reach the U.S. were already en route when the newest restrictions were announced. Emmanuel was making his way through Guatemala. The promise of the United States of freedom from persecution and violence persuaded Emmanuel and thousands like him to travel tens of thousands of miles across the oceans and mountains. Steps away from the southern border, they learned that the door had been slammed shut. Tijuana was never meant to be the final destination for Emmanuel or so many other asylum seekers. Rather, the city is just a place they wound up atrapado, stuck. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Politico.com. Read one of the obituaries this week. The singer who took South African sounds global, Joseph Shabalala, 1941-2020. Joseph Shabalala brought South African Zulu music to the ears of the world. As founder of the vocal ensemble Ladysmith Black Mambazo, Shabalala led the most successful group in African history, selling more than 30 million albums and performing everywhere from Sesame Street to Buckingham Palace and Nelson Mandela's inauguration. The group gained international renown after Paul Simon featured them on his acclaimed 1986 album Graceland, recorded in Johannesburg. Simon was criticized for violating the cultural boycott of South Africa's racist apartheid regime, but Shabalala saw a divine hand at work. Somebody was pushing him, and there's no way to stop it, he said. The music builds bridges. It's God himself, his spirit. For Shabalala, a Zulu growing up in apartheid-era South Africa, work options were limited, said NPR.org. He wanted to become a teacher or a doctor, but he had to quit school at age 12 after his father died and take over his father's work at a white-owned farm. At 17, he moved to the city of Durban, where he fixed cars while singing at night. In a dream, he had a vision of a group that would meld the warrior-like sound of the music performed by local song and dance competition teams with the textures of Christian choral singing. Named for his hometown, the color of the strongest oxen, and the Zulu word for axe, Ladysmith Black Mambazo became one of South Africa's biggest musical attractions, said the Financial Times. But even as rewards and awards came his way, Shabalala insisted he didn't lift his voice for recognition. There is something in me, in my veins, that needs music, he said. That's all. To me, it is good to sit down and sing. We'll go on over to the Talking Points page. I have an article, Kelly, No Longer Silent. John Kelly has jumped off the Trump train, said Kevin Cullen in the Boston Globe. In a speech at Drew University, President Trump's former chief of staff broke ranks with his former boss and defended Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, a decorated war hero who was pulled from the National Security Council and escorted from the White House in retaliation for his impeachment testimony. Vindman did exactly what we teach them to do, said Kelly, a retired Marine general. We teach them, don't follow an illegal order. Kelly also defended the news media, called migrants overwhelmingly good people, and said Trump was naive for thinking he could persuade North Korea to give up nuclear weapons. Trump fired back on Twitter, saying Kelly was in way over his head as chief of staff and has a military and legal obligation to keep his mouth shut. Actually, the reverse is true. Kelly is warning Americans that Trump is an insecure, vindictive man who retaliated against a career Army officer who literally bled for his country. The chatter generated by Kelly's words has largely avoided the most important point, said Greg Sargent in the Washington Post. Trump's former chief of staff fully validated the case against Trump that got him impeached. Kelly made it clear he believes Trump subverted U.S. policy on Ukraine's defensive fight against Russia to his own political ends, and that Vindman was right to object. Kelly gave voice to an even greater heresy, said Chris Saliza at CNN.com. He said the media is not the enemy of the people and warned that those who only watch Fox News are just reinforcing their beliefs and aren't informed citizens. It was a powerful rebuke of the blatantly pro-Trump network Republicans say they trust more than any other. Kelly's about-face is welcome, said Rick Wilson in the DailyBeast.com. But it's too little, too late, and too lame. As Trump's most senior advisor for 18 months, Kelly knew full well what a danger the ignorant, reckless president posed to our country. But with an eye on his military pension and future job opportunities, kept his mouth shut. Vindman showed more balls in one day than Kelly ever did in Trump's service. Still, better late than never, said the New Jersey Star-Ledger in an editorial. For Trump's former enablers, speaking up now won't wipe that stubborn orange stain off their reputations, but they owe it to the country just the same. We've got time for a couple of short notes, I think. We'll start with Uber and Lyft have exacerbated big cities traffic problems by luring customers away from public transportation and walking. According to multiple studies, in Chicago, ride-hailing trips starting or ending downtown rose over 300% between 2015 and 2018. In San Francisco, an average downtown traffic slowdown of 2.5 miles an hour between 2010 and 2016 has been linked to ride-hailing apps. Cruise ship bookings have dropped 10 to 15% because of fears raised by outbreaks of the coronavirus and extended quarantines on two cruise ships, according to an organization of travel agencies. Stories about the virus are front page news every day, said Richard Fain, Royal Caribbean's chief executive. That makes people a bit more cautious. President Trump may block National Security and State Department officials from listening in on his calls to foreign leaders. When you call a foreign leader, people listen, Trump said in a radio interview. I may end the practice entirely. Trump's Ukraine scandal began when a whistleblower filed a complaint about his call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. And we'll finish with a quote from Henry David Thoreau, who says, beware of all enterprises that require new clothes. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.